Okay, let's start again. We're very pleased to have Jonathan Fung from Irvine tell us about unparticle physics.
You got it?
Okay, so I actually like Zachary Chaco's statement about distance equals perspective, and I think I'm hoping that there won't be too much perspective in this talk. But there are certainly a lot of people in the audience who have worked on this, and hope they'll help out when they feel it. So, the overview is this is yet again another idea for new physics that's weakly coupled to the standard model. And again, like as in the Hidden Valley case, it's weakly coupled to heavy mediators. So, we have a picture where we have a standard model here. And we've got some mediation sector over here, and then some new set physics over here. And the wrinkle here is that we're going to be completely concerned only with conformal field theories over here. But this has sort of the form of a hidden valley, and so I certainly agree with Matt that there are many similarities. Now, preparing this talk actually wasn't that easy. As you know, there are many papers, and moderators have joked about starting a new FRK-FN. But actually, that's not the biggest problem in trying to give a talk like this. The biggest problem is that there are still many basic outstanding questions, at least to me. Really simple questions you can ask, which I think the answers are kind of not so clear. So what I'm going to try to do is really try to focus on the straight and the narrow, not get into too many side issues, and try to get to the heart of the matter, especially as it's relevant for LHC phenomenology, and then also especially with an eye to the fact that we're going to have a discussion section on this tomorrow. And John Chang and Greg will lead us, and I think they have prepared some slides for it. And so the idea is to sort of provide some groundwork. Many people here have contributed, hopefully I will provide some of their context for their work, and then we'll talk about that a lot later. Okay, so this whole thing begins then once you start talking about this, and I'm going to assume, and I apologize if this is not true for you, but I'm going to assume that you really haven't dug into the Zen particle papers much in another minute. So the first thing to do is just to describe what the CFD is. And CFD, conformal field theories, are things that satisfy conformal invariants. Conformal invariance is an extension of the Poincaré group. And as part of it, not all of it, there is scale invariance. Okay, so this is right off the bat, somewhat confusing at least to me. There's certainly the fact that conformal invariance implies scale invariance. Whether scale invariance implies conformal invariance is not formally true, but there are statements that in all sort of interesting cases it's true also. But for us, right here, we're just going to basically be thinking about scale invariance. And so they look the same on all spaces. So what are the transformations? Well, there's a space-time transformation, which is on the space coordinate x, so they get rescaled. And then you can rescale the fields with some factor, where this key to the d alpha, if you can't see in the back, and d is the scaling dimension of this field. So classical field theories are conformal if they have no dimensional parameters, and you can realize that very quickly because you just simply identify the naive mass dimension of every field with its charge, and then because Lagrangian has the right mass units, automatically then your theory is conformal. Basically, you assign charge 1 for the boson field, standard model is not conformal even as a classical field theory, because as you know, there is one massive parameter in the standard model, and that's the Higgs mass. So that brings the conformal symmetry. Okay, now, even at the classical level, if you have a conformal theory, at the quantum level, you may not. And so this is actually very much the case in the real world. If you took QED without giving a mass away, you would still not have a conformal theory because, as you know, the dimensionless couplings, even though they only have dimensionless couplings in the theory, depend on the scale. And so there is renormalization group evolution, here's my little picture of scale, here's the coupling, and here's the case where you're in the QED situation, and here's the case where you're in the QCD situation. And so even though classically they have no dimension bulk parameters, they're still not formal because of these quantum dimensions. So what we're talking about is not those things, we're talking about informal field theories, which are informal even at the quantum level. And there's a long history to this, and the work certainly has sort of motivated the way Georgi wrote his first paper, and sort of you can take as a starting point is Dank's theories. So these are theories where the theory of function, the theories of SU3 with NF flavors, and people have actually calculated the beta function to three loops, and here it is. And so there's one term that goes to Q, one is Q, one is Q7. And what Banks and Zach noted, among many other things, was that if you pick the number of flavors correctly, you can make this first beta zero, beta not coefficient, very small. And then it's possible that even though this parameter here has extra power in the coupling, G squared, it, and it's suppressed for that reason, it can deal the same order as this and cancel this one out. And so it's possible that picking the right number of flavors, you can actually be in a regime where you have complete control of theory. For derivative, G is small. Nevertheless, this is zero because the sort of first leading order term is sort of accidentally suppressed because the number of derivatives is small and cancels off the next one. And then after that, of course, you can neglect all the other ones. So it's pretty sure that this is actually zero. So we don't need to go into detail exactly what NF actually satisfies this, but you have a picture that's something like this. In the ultraviolet, you have the free theory, and it does something, but then it's also infrared free, or infrared stable. Okay, so when you get down here, you actually reach a point where the beta function is again zero, and you flow to a perturbative infrared stable exponent. Okay, so that's an example you can keep in the back of your mind. Another example is supersymmetric theories, where you have Yang-Mills, supersymmetric Yang-Mills, SUNT, with NF flavors again, n equals 1. And for a range of flavor, NF is the number of flavors, you can have a situation where you flow again to an infrared stable fixed point, so something like this. However, in this case, you flow to a strongly coupled one, so somewhere up here. And of course, that makes it harder to show that you've actually done that, but that's the great achievement of the 90s cipher. You know. So there are examples which you can very explicitly put in if you want to think about informal field theory. So what are unparticles? So unparticles are when you couple that thing we just talked about, the conformal field theory, to the scanner model. Through non-renewable other couplings, which are parameterized by some high mass scale M. So here's the picture over here. At some very high scale M, you have these non-renormalizable couplings. So there's an OSM, which is the standard model operator. And then there's an OUV, which is the hidden sector, or unparticle operator. And Georgi calls that OBZ, for open set. But we want to be a little more general than that. We don't want to just think about the weakly coupled, and that we're probably more interested in the strongly coupled. So I'm going to call this OUV, aside from the fact that it's in the vector. Single-handedly doubled the use of telegraphic letters in FDA. Okay, so that's fine. That's a theory, and you know, theory is the Sierra model. Then the thing runs, and the assumption is that the unparticle sector becomes conformal at some other scale, lambda u, so down here somewhere, and sure enough, here is the picture where this coupling becomes flat. And the assumption for right now is that that theory becomes conformal all the way into the infrared. Along the way, first let me note that the idea is that this is a conformal, by itself, a conformal sector. Of course, now we're coupling it to the standard model, and so you might wonder whether that perturbation actually screws things up and makes it non-conformal. But the hope here is that these operators are going to be, of course, less and less important as you go to the infrared, and so presumably they don't spoil the conformality. Okay, along the way, as the coupling revolves here, also the operators evolve, and this original operator OUV in ultraviolet, which has some typical dimension of, you know, 1 or 2 or some integer, then evolves to a bunch of operators O, which have a dimension D, and in principle the D's are not necessarily the same as the DUVs. Okay, so Matt talks, I think, a great deal about this, the study of anomalous dimension. In the Banks-Zach case, with a weakly coupled theory, the D and the DUV are about the same because it's all preparative, so there's small jiggles there. But in the strong coupling case, it's very possible, and that's what we're going to think about now, that the D and the DUV are different by, you know, a lot. And so we're really basically more interested in these sort of hybrid-type strongly coupled conformal theories down in this region. But of course, everything applies to the weakly coupled. Now, one critical parameter that comes up in these theories is this D, because you see what happens is, so you start up here, this OUV has some dimension, it's suppressed therefore by the right amount of M's. Once you go over to here, you get basically dimensional transmutation, and so you pick up extra powers of lambda U, and that depends on what the dimension of this new conformal operator is. And so a lot of the phenomenology depends on this parameter D. What do we know about D? Well, there's this work from long ago by Max, 1977, which basically analyzed all the representations of CFTs and found that unitarity requires different things for different kinds of O's. So for scalar O's, space-time scalars, then D has to be bigger than 1. For vector O's, D has to be bigger than about 3. And this leads to some confusion because in the literature, many of us, I definitely include myself, didn't realize that this was a bound from unitarity. And there's all sorts of results plotted in the case which this is violated.
You can get around that.
Yeah, so you can tell me this.
Now, I'm going to tell you that if you looked at a tensor operator, the bound would be 2, like for F mu nu.
Uh-huh.
And then if you wrote F mu nu in terms of the gauge field A mu, that tells you A mu has a dimension bigger than 1. So this is for a current, basically, and for a gauge boson.
Yeah,
bound is 1 again.
Okay, great. So that's one loophole. The other loophole,
that's
which...
That's going to gain as your variance. It means gain variance. It's not consistent with the scale.
Right. So this is what I was trying to indicate here, that if it's not gauge invariant, that's a loophole.
Yeah.
The other one is that you could always assume that your theory over here is scale invariant, but not conformal invariant. And in fact, George, I had advocated this in response to an email where someone pointed out this inconsistency, but whether this is actually happening in any sort of reasonable theories is something I don't really care. Thank you. So there we have the picture of one particle. That's the general setup. And then the first thing that comes out of this is the easy part. That is that there are now interactions that are introduced by this. So you have these non-renormalizable interactions between a conformal operator and a standard model operator. And you can just go to town and write down all sorts of gauge invariant operators. And so apologize for those in the back. What's listed here are a bunch of examples of spin couplings to spin 0 conformal operators, couplings to spin 1 conformal operators, couplings to spin 2 tensor conformal operators. And then you just tack on to that whatever standard model gauge invariant operator you like. And so, for example, there's a F bar F O, so that's a O coupling to, you know, plus or minus. And these are all then suppressed by the appropriate power of lambda U, varies depending on what D U is, what the dimension of the object is. Okay, and then so there's a bunch of vertices that come out of this, which have been completely enumerated, as far as I can tell, by King and Chung and collaborators. And there's actually already been a workshop devoted to M particles in Taiwan, and he presented all this there. If you're interested. Yeah, so let's see. If you want to have spinners, of course, you don't usually have spinner scanner model operators that are gauge invariant. Right? So that means you have to complete the gauge invariant by having the conformal operator have some scanner model gauge members. Okay, without exception. Oh, yeah, I'm going to talk about H in a minute. But anyway, that is one interesting possibility. And actually, John, I hope we'll talk about that later. The idea that conformal operators actually have gauge property. Okay, so there's a bunch of the interactions. And the one thing I wanted to say is, first of all, you can see why there's a lot of activity, because you can pick whatever you want here and kind of calculate the contribution to whatever your favorite process is. And that's been done. so this is the easy part. There may also be super normalizable couplings, which I want to defer for later. So, for example, here's an operator coupling to H squared, which has actually a positive power of a mass in front, and the 2 minus d, which is positive d's between 1 and 2. And this is very important, but I will talk about this in a little bit later. Yes.
So, can I think about Bang's acceptor as when I evolve the Hamming constant, then a finite energy beta function expansion, and then stays 0?
I guess you could, right?
Well, it's reaching a different fixed point problem.
Or Eric's 3D infrared 0 one?
Oh, okay. It, at this point, yeah, we can assume that it's basically infrared, conformal all the way down to the infrared. I mean, it doesn't, certainly it's conformal through the weak scale and all scales like that. Yes. Well, you know, exactly what the definition of lambda u is a little bit subject to some uncertainties, but roughly it's right where this thing flattens out. And in fact, I mean, in some sense, there's an extra degree of freedom here because you have arbitrary constants in front here too. So, in some sense, you can absorb any sort of small change in lambda u by changing these constants. Right? So the definition is not so strong. Okay, so now one thing you need to do if you want to do unparticle phenomenology is you probably want to think about the case where you have an unparticle in the final state. Why is this? Because then you have diagrams where there's only one unparticle coupling, and presumably those are one of the leading contributions because they're not suppressed by as many normalizable operators. So the first thing you want to do is figure out how to integrate over phase space when you have an unparticle in the final state. And it turns out this leads to all sorts of interesting things. So, the density of unparticle final states, the phase space basically, is the spectral density rho, which is defined as follows in terms of a Fourier transform of a two-point correlation function. And the nice thing is that by scale invariance, you can actually figure out what this thing ought to be. Because this thing here has dimensions of 2d, and here has dimensions of 1, and so you can figure out that this has to have dimensions of d minus 2. And it's a function of t squared, and so that's at that dimensions of 2d minus 4, and so that's what this has to be. And so just by the fact that you're assuming this is conformal, you can find the form of this up to an unknown constant. And here, Georgi made an interesting observation, which is that this phase space here is actually very similar to the phase space you'll get for n massless particles. Okay, so you know there's a, you can write down a Lorentz invariant phase space, which looks like this. D4k, that's on betas and deltas and the overall momentum conservation. And you can integrate a lot of this out until you get this form for the just the standard massless particles phase space. And this has a p squared to the n minus 2, and that's it in terms of the dimension full parameters. And so that's exactly like this form, except here we replace the n, the number of massless particles, with d, which is the dimension of this new topic. And there's actually a coefficient up here, and if you want, you can pick this coefficient to equal that coefficient in the case where d is an entity. So what George I said is that we should identify, or we can identify n with du, and what we conclude therefore is that an unparticle, well, first of all, if the unparticle has dimension 1, you can check that this thing reproduces completely just the one massless particle phase space. And so d equals 1 unparticle is a standard massless particle. That's it. However, you can also identify unparticles with some other dimension d as looking like a non-integral number du of massless particles. So this is where it starts getting weird, because we're not used to thinking about, you know, 1.5 particle phase space. It is, well, it's relevant for a second. I'll show you why this one part of it is. But it's a normalization convention that defines how you're going to normalize these LSTs.
So physical predictions should not depend on
results. If you knew what the UV theory was, then this is just some normalization of the field.
It shouldn't, because I can always rescale offset u, but...
So I think...
you'd have to rescale the
absorb it, though. Right, you can absorb it into a coupling. As John says, you had some fundamental theory where you know what the coupling is, then this is not. Then you can't do that, so... Given this just low-energy parameterization, yeah.
But in general, when you just do a cost-efficient calculation for the downfall down, it does depend on
AU,
right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But then
you can just split AU is equal to AN?
Or when
N
is equal to
AU?
Yeah.
Split that dimension.
Right. And you
can look at space
space. You're saying that this spectral density is
based on
space.
Space.
So why?
Well, okay, so the spectral density, just remember, what is that? It's the thing that has a delta function when you have a physical particle and then a delta function at the max, right? And so you have typically delta functions, and then if you have some continuum of states, like two particle states or something, you have some thing, right? That's all I'm doing, the exact same thing.
But if you say that this is the phase space.
Get from the cut of the propagator.
Yeah, that's where I must be.
So you cut George I's propagator, this is the phase space you get.
Why do you need a standard phase you will get 12 months?
Yeah. Well, okay, so let me show you that in the next slide here. Okay. And so let me just say, as a sort of aside here, I haven't gotten the LHC signals yet, but as you'll see, all this stuff is very counterintuitive and directly relevant for thinking about how you might use it at the LHC, so please bear with us here.
John?
Yes?
What do you call the spectral density of not what people usually call the spectral? Spectral quotient is the density of the particles. Spectral quotient.
Okay.
Take the limit, if he goes to 1, you get a delta function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is that. So, okay, so let me just get to this, and then we can keep talking.
The absence of corruption is absence of mass.
So, this business about having a non-integral number of particles is one way to maybe get some handle on it, but a alternative, and certainly in my case, more palatable interpretation is something due to Stefanov, which you call unparticle deconstruction. And this is just a way to see the result that we just got in terms of standard particle physics. Okay. So let me just reproduce for you here this spectral density, which I wrote down on the previous slide already. Here it is. And this AN here is this constant out front that's this more or less arbitrary normalization. Now, let's look at this a little more carefully. When B goes to 1, then this thing goes to minus 1. We have a 1 over p squared. However, and so that goes to infinity at p squared goes to 0. However, there's also a gamma of n minus 1 in here, which goes to infinity. And in the denominator, so this goes to 0. So what this is saying is that when b goes to 1, this thing reproduces a delta function. So you squash down everything except for the part that has singularity of p squared equals 0. And so that is why, in this agrees with what Jordan says, that the delta functions come out when b equals 1, and an unparticle b equals 1 is a massless particle. Now for other values of b, this rho spreads out to higher p squared, so I should have probably drawn this, but you know, this is going to be 1 over p squared square root or something. And so it's not going to be a delta function anymore. It's going to have some, you know, continuum. And that's typically very weird in a one-particle state. But what Stefanov urged us to do is to think of this as a decomposition into a bunch of little delta functions, which are not delta functions exactly because they're not normalized to 1. Okay, so you have this continuum of states, and you're just going to chop it up so each part of it looks like a particle with a definite mass. However, the height of that delta function is not 1. The integral under it is not 1. So what this leads to is the view that an unparticle is a collection of unnormalized particles with continuum of masses. So one unparticle does not have a well-defined mass. It actually has a continuum of masses. And those sort of constituent pieces of the n particle have sort of interactions which are suppressed by how much less than a complete delta function each one of those spikes is. So let me just finish this up. So the idea here, and this is what is helpful about this, is that this says that an unparticle is this collection of particles which in bulk, on the whole, couples significantly, because there's a significant area under this continuum of spectral density. But each individual particle couples infinitesimally, if you take the limit where it's infinitely thin, like a delta function. And so what this means is that you can make unparticles, but they can't decay. Okay, because you can make them and mass, but once you've made one of them, that interaction is so weak, it never decays back. And so, for those of you who do large extra dimensions, it's similar to some extent to the case where you have a Kluge-Klein tower of graviton states, and any one of them is interacting with a strength of 1 over m Planck, but when you sum them all up, they interact with a strength of 1 over m weak. Right? And it's similar to that, except this is the ultimate extreme of that interpretation, where you actually each individual one doesn't even interact with 1 over m Planck, they just completely non-interact. And so this helps, I think, understand some of the results we're going to get.
The step further with that is you can remember that this description is self-dual and very, very much like QCD. In particular, if you have, you imagine a QCD-like theory which is close to conformal high energy, it's a finite state, then what it has is a power of Hadamard states. If you look at two-point functions that operate in QCD, it gives you the sum of the poles. So it's really just QCD. Deconstruction queuing is basically ADS-C with a cutoff, ADS-C of QCD cutoff, which is in fact how QCD gets to produce ADS-C. So it's what really makes it precise.
Can you ever say that you could have produced one of those states, but you always have this series? Produce a bunch of those good state, so they, in that case, they don't decay.
Well, no, so the, I think the way to think about it is the chance of producing one of a set is non-zero, so you can make one. But once you've made one, you should think of it as interacting so weakly that it never decays.
This normalization was essential for the theory of the definition. Normalization takes some time.
No, but so what we're doing is we're taking this area under this curve, we're dividing it into little rectangles, and we're taking the width of each rectangle to zero.
No, no,
so we're not
reproducing the delta function in the limit n to zero. This is n to one. This is n to one. But there is, we use the argument that there is a gamma of n minus one in place of n.
Yeah, so the idea is there is
not absolutely arbitrary, this normalization, we're calling it. It's irrelevant to that.
Oh, yeah. If you want the unparticle in the case when delta e goes to 1 to exactly reproduce the massless particle results, then that fixes that at that point at e equals 1. Yeah. Right.
So, you said
that
there is a difference because, I mean, in graph cases, it's not a continuum, it's still a discrete. These are actually, you actually go to the limit here, you go.
Yeah, but he said you could take
zero.
Right.
Then it's not move all.
There is a limit where you're not far, there's this limit is happening.
Yeah, but you take
the guard discrete states.
Okay, so it's a
I mean, you can map one over to the other.
I mean, Michael said take the lambda arbitrary so you can
explain. Yeah, okay. You don't care about phenomenological constraints of the radius.
You know, as a my point of view, we're just desperate to get any handle on this at all,
right.
So if we throw out phenomenological constraints, that's okay. That's fine. Okay, so anyway, this may be helpful somehow. Okay, so now let's think about finally some implications of it. So one of the first things George I considered was to consider the decay top goes to up in particle. Okay, so flavor violating decay. And in some sense it's very straightforward now at this point to figure out what happens. You write down some coupling, say the scalar operator or the derivative to some vector current u bar gamma t, gamma t. That's the interaction. And then you have a final u in the final state, so then you just put that phase space factor in, and you carry out your standard Feynman-Diagram calculation. And what you find, one thing you can find, is this result here, where what's plotted is the energy of the u quark divided by m top from 0 to 1 half, and this is the sort of differential width, the d log gamma d u. And so there's a bunch of different lines here, and they depend then on this dimension of the O operator. The vastness gets bigger or smaller as you're going to higher d, but let me just get to the point. If d goes to 1, then this thing gets all bunched up over here, okay? Which is exactly what you'd expect, because in the limit that d equals 1, then what you have is the n particle is a massless, standard massless particle. And then you have two massless particles, up and n particle. And so each one gets half of the energy of the top quark, and you're done. It's just a delta function. But when d starts varying from 1, now the n particle stops being one massless particle, but more a collection of states. And then this thing starts sort of smearing out. So then it starts going like this, and this, and this, and this. And so you start getting these very, very weird situations where you have a two-body decay, but the particle that you see is up quark, does not have a single energy in the rest frame of the is a signal of uncertainty. Okay, it was unfamiliar to me.
Well, in the sense that if you imagine, if you just think about tau decay, imagine taking the tau mass, so it's not right at this case, then this is decaying by a current particle. Now, you have a dimension, so you can think about that as a two body decay, and tau decays from the three members of the current. But then what does the current do? It creates some number of habits. Sum up all the inclusive, and you get the agreement of these rules. But it's just saying that there's a lot of different possible decay modes, and you add them all up, they come up with these things.
Okay. I think of it as unparticle, as a single particle leaving the detector. So, in that sense, it's very not counterintuitive. It's just saying that's a better way to look at it.
You're saying that there's only one gauge invariant operator. Thinking about it as particles is not the case. You think about it as non-particles.
Okay, so, and then just note that at least from the way I understood Stefanov's interpretation, this seems to make sense because the collection of particles that the unparticle is not a one definite mass, it's a continuum of masses, and of course you know that if you had a continuum different masses in the final state, then you would get the spread of final state energies for the output. So that kind of is consistent with that.
The best way is this, and this is just a correction, right? Putting it like having it. Because the only difference is that you don't have force, right? You see, if it's exactly the same, it's exactly the same, it's force. But you don't go to that picture, right? You see the three features. You don't go to that picture, you see. But
okay, so then let's go on. The other possibility is that the unparticles can have effects through their being virtual particles, not real particles in the final state.
Can I take this one question?
Okay.
Sorry, this question. Can I think of this as maybe your head is out? If you see on the W comes to 50 watts and that, but a streamer. I asked the question on the previous screen, I asked what the angle step is about. That's the answer to this?
Well, the question is exclusive versus inclusive. Exclusive, you've got a lot of different final states. The sum of the law is the constraint, which is all the states that are created by an object. So the question is for Georgia,
okay, so let's go on. The other ingredient we need to think about this is unparticle propagators, and this is also determined by scaling invariance. Spectral density is very much related to this, so you get some answer, and I don't really want to go into great detail except to note two things. You have a propagator which has a 1 over q squared 2 minus b in the denominator. And so that's the thing where you would expect the mass to show up, is the q squared minus m squared. So there's no mass gap because informal symmetry is assumed that you get all the way down to the low scale. And in the numerator, there's this funny factor, imaginary. Numbers, complex numbers. And this strange phase can lead to some interesting effects with regard to when you interfere with different scan and model processes. Okay, one last thing is that there's also the fact that this thing becomes infinite. There's a sine b pi down here. It becomes infinite when b is an integer. When b equals 1, there's another effect in the ab that cancels that out, so that's actually well behaved. But for 2, 3, and higher integers, then you actually have this infinite propagator. And so many people have taken that to mean that they shouldn't take dimensions bigger than 2. Although, as far as I can see, there's no nothing wrong with, you know, in terms of 2.5%.
So is he just the dimensional big space?
Yeah, it comes from the same place that it came from in the spectral density, so it's derived from that, basically.
Yes.
So you want to take a free two free phis and describe them with a single propagator?
Yes. Yeah. If you treat there is perfectly different from the truth, you can do it for us.
Yeah.
And in that case, we do the truth.
Propagator, you can ask, you know, what happens if you higher D, this thing is becoming more and more UV sensitive. And D equals 2 turns out to be right where this effect is less important than the contact interaction that you would generate if it would be
thick.
Oh, so it may be that, so I think that, you know, there's a sense in which when you couple this thing to the standard model, this range D goes from 1 to 2, I think, is the range for which the low energy part of the unparticle thing dominates the coupling of the standard model. Would you agree with that, John?
Yeah. So that
the larger projections, you get this kind of thing actually. You say, well, that's another thing, and I put it down on the contact dimension.
You could do that. You could go to something in the
order. And then when I have production, there's a separate bound that I get from that.
Yeah,
so why do people do that in the unparticle? Usually the phenomenon will actually be very interesting.
I was just saying the leading effect in that case would just be a contact interaction.
Yeah.
Which is also, this is something you can certainly study, it's already been studied, right? All possible contact interactions in the standard model, etc.
I think the idea is that when D is between 1 and 2, then there's something new that we haven't studied, that, so that's why they're looking at that.
Although even in that case, these things come back to look like contact interactions. So there's some power of the mass gap.
Oh,
okay, so what I've done so far is presented all I want to about sort of the formalism of trying to calculate observables and particles. And then there are many ways to go. So there are collider signals, there are low-energy probes, there are astrophysics, and all of these have been studied at least a little, and in some cases a lot. So first, for real unparticle production, there are therefore implications for monophoton or monojet signals, at left for Fevertine and LHC, respectively. So this should have been E plus E minus the gamma U. So you have a U in the final state, and at least at this point, this U doesn't appear. It's just an invisible particle, so it's a missing energy. And then similarly with monojets at the Fevertine LHC. There's been some study on this that it seems to indicate that because you can't pin down the longitudinal momentum at the LHC and Fevertron, this is impossible, but sort of ILCs that actually see something like this. Then there's the virtual unparticle exchange. So then you get into cases where you have two interactions possibly, E plus E minus U and U plus E minus U leading to E plus E minus goes to U plus E minus. And, you know, just the question of which unparticle couplings you want to turn on. You could turn on, you can make dimuons, diphotons, diz's, di anything else you want. and you know, there's a lot of things to do there. In some cases, this ends up looking a lot like a contact interaction. Well, let me say this first. In the scalar case, of course, this doesn't interfere with the standard model. And the other thing is that there's no resonance structure here, because this U is really massless. You're not looking for bumps of anything. You're just looking for enhanced cross-section or backward asymmetries, maybe, things like that. In the vectron particle case, then you really do have something that looks just as if you had a Z or a photon in the S channel, and so you're producing stuff that interferes with the standard model, and this is really, you know, you just take contact interaction studies going all the way back to Eichten Lane Peskin, and just you can almost directly translate all those bounds into bounds on particle scales.
Could I ask a question at this point? Suppose you did the spectral case and you use those bounds, does it then imply that U would be a direct reduction of a use of U rather than a contact interaction would be invisible as a detector? You would have some lower bound on your scale, and does that make the interaction so weak that you definitely don't see it on your detector?
No, those are completely decoupled scales in this case. So that puts a bound, I mean, in this particular framework we talked about so far, the U is just stable and non-interacting. So that's a fact, irrespective of whether this lambda turns out to be 100 GeV or 10 GeV.
It's not totally non-interacting. It's got some coupling to standard model stuff through some operator structure.
Well, see, this is exactly where it gets confusing, because that seems like that ought to make sense, but if you use the Stefanov picture, the particle you produce is just one of this huge continuum, and that thing is always interacting. It doesn't decay. Well, the difference is this wasn't a real particle.
I think these are just maybe I don't know how precise you can make it, but if you just think of this stuff as radiation, it's massless, right? It doesn't have any mass, so it's sort of like radiation. You don't expect radiation to decay.
Right.
But to me, that doesn't seem so weird.
It's like bound space.
Another way to say it is,
just like radiation.
If you take a hydrogen atom, you can calculate an excited state decays to a photon, or emits a photon, with the probability that the photon comes back into the hydrogen atom, the excited hydrogen atom state, zero. If you couple to a continuum, probability leaks into the continuum, it doesn't leak back.
We're kind of flipping, as we talk, we're flipping in different interpretations. This Stefanov, and there actually are states that have mass.
I know,
right?
I'm just saying this is another interpretation, which to me doesn't seem so weird to say that stuff doesn't come back.
Yeah, but that's exactly
what
you're saying.
I think it's
John.
The same with
the
ring,
of course.
Yeah,
that was.
Yeah. Okay, then there are also low energy probes. They're anomalous magnetic moment contributions. Anyway, you have, you know, it completely depends on what you assume for this O, whether it's a scalar vector or something. But roughly speaking, any time you had, for example, a photon, you could stick in a U. CP violation, capitalizing on this weird phase in the propagator, has been studied. Fifth force experiments, capitalizing on the fact that this is in some sense very light. And so there's a bunch of possibilities there. And then there's also astrophysical studies, not as many, but a few. Supernova cooling, because if you can do this, shed off a U, of course the first thing astrophysically you ask is, how does this cool supernovae? And even BBN, dark matter, etc.
So,
the way I think of contact interactions, they're always vector couplings, right?
No, I mean, they're a generalized ones. I mean, you can still think of it as scalar times scalar interactions. It's going to be V times V or V times A.
Okay.
Which
was related to the
place of the office? They did not dimension 6 not yet. That's only going to be a B equals 2. The B equals 4.4 is some other dimension.
Yeah, that's right.
So when the limit when D goes to 2, then it looks like a normal dimension, and hence a gauge. said one, then it looks like a normal with a wrong dimension.
So can you mention
wrong?
That's gotta be the same.
It's not obvious. Why is that? It's not obvious to me that this thing should be. When you say it's like a contact interaction, what I guess you mean is that you're saying that this unparticle exchange is somehow dominated by the is it dominated by a high? It's not more dominated by low energies or something. I mean, I thought of the Hadron machine got PDFs, and so you're always sort of dominated by the lowest energy.
Okay, so yeah, maybe I'm being too glib here. Let's take the E plus E minus machine, okay, where I have a definite center of mass energy.
Yeah.
Then the thing going through the propagator is just a constant. And so the fact that, you know, how the mass is split up between the propagator and the interaction vertices is different. But the end result is I can take a bound on the contact interaction from left and just apply it straight over to the surface.
Okay, but if you have a smeared energy, you may be sensitive.
Yeah, so a smeared energy, yeah, you got to work a little harder, but morally it's
kind of. I just wanted to know how precise the math is. It's kind of like a contact interaction, which is exactly like that.
Okay, yeah, so it's not, it's kind of like. Okay, so, you know, there's a whole bunch of things I
hope. Unlike.
Unexpectedly unlike.
Wait, it's just that it has a form factor.
If it's at a hadron collider, yeah. Okay, so I was not saying I talked about each one of these in any great detail, but what I wanted to point out is the following fact to motivate the rest of the talk, which is that there are roughly then high energy probes and there are low energy probes. So high energy probes are, for example, from left. Low energy probes are, for example, from supernovae, where the characteristic energies are 10 MeV. And to make a long story short, there's tons of results in the literature now. And I picked two, one from a paper I wrote, and one from a paper of Hannestad, Raphael, and Wong, because these happen to plot things in the same way, and you can kind of guess what the results are. And these are not meant to be definitive best studies in like this, although probably given Raphael's and supernovae, this one is. But anyway, here you see that depending on what so this is the lambda U M plane. This is the lambda U M plane. And the difference is that here I plotted up to 10 TeV, whereas 10 TeV is down here on this plane. And all the area under these curves is excluded by constraints. So these graphs have three different curves for different Ds. Okay, they're almost the same. This is 2, 3.5, and 1. This is 1.1, 1.5, and 1.9. But the basic point I want to make simply is that if you just looked at all these things naively, you would come to the very rapid conclusion that the low energy bounds have completely eliminated any chance of seeing any unparticle effects at all in high energy colliders. Okay, they're just orders of magnitude stronger. And so the obvious question is, when I talk about this today, workshop with a lot of LHC. The reason is that there's a whole other thing which I've completely avoided so far, and that is that the conformal symmetry is not expected to actually remain around all the way until you get to the low energies where the supernovae studies are done. And so this is work of Patty Fox, Gary Sherman, and Arvin Rajaraman. And what they pointed out is the very simple observation that when electric symmetry breaking happens, that will trigger conformal symmetry breaking through the super renormalizable operator with the O and the H squared here. So I already showed this previously, but let me just look at it again. This is, of course, the Higgs portal. This is the one place where you get a super renormalizable coupling to the standard model. And this then has a positive dimensional parameter in front. And so this is a big deal. And as soon as H gets above V, then this gives a tadpole to the O, and that should break conformal symmetry. In other words, you've got now a mass in your O conformal theory, and that's a dimensionful parameter, so it's not conformal anymore. And so the picture really, in this case, looks like this. You have some UV which flows to a conformal theory, but But somewhere you break that conforming grain, and that's what they call lambda u slash. And lambda u slash can be very easily estimated just by putting a v squared in here and asking what is the mass scale in this operator. And the point here is that if you want to do unparticle physics, you're confined to work in the conformal window between lambda u slash and lambda u. And so there's a window of energy scales where the conformal symmetry is presumably good, and it's not good above and it's not good below. So now you can ask more quantitatively, how big is this window? And the answer is, unless you do something either highly fine-tuned or appeal to something which I'll talk about, you have a very narrow conformal window in the sense that it's, you know, we assume that it starts somewhere around a GeV, so we can think about collider physics, and it's gone by the time you get to 10 GeV, typically. So this is a plot where this is the dimension of this parameter, this is the energy, and you can ignore all the curves on here except for these that say lambda u slash. So lambda u is right here, it's set to 250 GeV. So this is when where the conformal window opens, and lambda u slash is where it closes. And you see that in this case, where you have sort of order one couplings, it's closed by the time you get to 100 GeV. So you have that narrow window where you can talk about something being conformal in some sense, but it doesn't exist very long. If you make this coupling in the front here small, this C2, you assume it's maybe a loop factor down, 10 to the minus 2 or something, 10 to the minus 3, then you can make this lambda u slash get down to the tens of GeV. But, you know, we're not ever going to pick a small number and convince ourselves that we should think about 10 MeV where the conformal window is still open. Okay, so what are the implications here? First one, very relevant here, is that when you see, you know, the half of the unparticle papers that come out with incredibly tight bounds for low energy constraints, those are only applicable in fine-tuned models, or at least models where this operator doesn't exist. Right? Somehow you have to get rid of this operator. Of course, there are ways to do it. You could assume that there are no scalar operators. You could assume all the scalar operators have mass and energy bigger than 2. So, you know, there are ways to do it. But it's the standard thing, if you write down an O with a dimension from 1 to 2, this conformal window is not open to low energies. Fox et al. Proposed, based on this, that the propagator be modified and this is basically just simply the fact of placing a p squared with a p squared minus mu squared in here, where the mu is where that lambda u slash is, so that's where the conformal symmetry breaks. And so that's one obvious implication. Now you're going to generate a mass gap, and to the extent that these are similar to Hidden Valley models, that makes them very much more similar. They have a mass gap on the conformal symmetry breaks. There are many other implications, hopefully many of the people here. So colored unparticles then become a possibility when you have this, and that's very different because now you have particles that are not invisible, like colored unparticle production. These three operators here, Davis. Higgs physics is also clearly going to be impacted, and I think this is very interesting because, of course, as soon as you start coupling the O's to Higgs's, you can have effects on electric symmetry breaking, and I think Mariano is going to mention something about that later. But this, as far as I know, is sort of the only sort of link we have of unparticles into the weak scale. I mean, one thing I've completely avoided is, why do we think that unparticles exist at the weak scale? There's very little motivation, but this sort of direction is the way to go if you want to think about that. And then finally, there are now are unresonances. Previously, I talked about the fact that there were no resonances because this thing was a massless particle, like a photon. Now it's not massless because it has a mass generated by this conformal breaking. And Tom dubbed these unresonances, and I don't know if Tom's actually going to be around tomorrow, so I thought I'd show this. Here are some plots of unresonances. And so this is in some channel.
This is Drell-Yan in the Tevatron.
Okay. So this is, you know, this is the resonance. And these different colors correspond, I think, to different...
different values of the...
dimensions, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so different dimensions D. And in this case, they correspond to different values of the informal breaking scale. So you see them moving at different places.
Can I just get a high tail on the resonance?
Why do you get a high tail?
Yeah.
Actually, what you really have is a step function turn on. Okay, what you're really seeing is a step and then a tail. And the reason why it has any, you know, really, you know, it doesn't come up like exactly like a step, it's resolution. So
the object data as far as the sufficient function calls?
It's the, or, yeah.
In simple words, what's the step function?
Well, let's go back on the... I mean, before here, you see that if you look at the, it's a theta function.
Right.
Okay, so you don't get any effect until you get the q squared bigger than the breaking scale. So there's no effect, and then suddenly this thing turns on. And normally, you would just see a flat, you know, a wall, and then the effect coming down, but because the resolution, it smooths it out a little bit.
Okay, I understand that you get a step function, but why do you have to
Well,
the same reason you do for an ordinary particle.
It's
threshold.
You're just crossing the threshold.
Yeah. Can't hear you.
Why would you? Well, you got the sequence part of the threshold.
No. There's only one. I mean.
So why do you sequence yourself?
You don't. Those were different values of the parameter.
Sorry.
Those were different values of mu, just to see what it's...
You're just turning on...
Right, what it looks like. Right. But the issue, what are the issues... Can we go back? Okay. One of the issues that came up, and we've discussed this, and maybe you want to say something about this, is that once you break the conformal symmetry, then you should think of these particles, these individual resonances as being unstable, and so some width factor should go into this. I don't know if you're going to bring this up or not. And... Well, we talked about this at lunch, and I think this is an issue here. We'll talk.
The whole issue of n-particle decay is very confusing.
Is there more to this when you're just stuck in a threshold? I mean, you could, because you did.
Is there more? I didn't do this. I mean, I just used it.
But you know what? I have a suggestion. Maybe we should wait. I think Mariana might have more to say about this.
Yeah.
Right? About the whole issue of whether this is a valid spectral density to use. So you will have something more to say about it.
I mean, is it fair to say that this mascot thing, this form that they produced, it's not derived directly from some Lagrangian. It's something, it's a model which gets certain features right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think some of the answer to your question is that, you know, it's probably not something that you have to take absolutely seriously. As an exact function. It has certain right limits or something, but not more than that.
Mm-hmm. It's on the level with Randall Sundrum where you chop off the space at the TV scale, let's say.
But then
my space ends here.
It gives you a different
result. It means you're more right? Because
yeah.
It's
more pronounced. That's at least a model.
Yeah,
you may not believe the model.
Yes.
It's
then how do you not get with the resonance?
Yeah.
It's underlying theory. You should have some property with QCD, because resonance. Mass resonance, gap of resonance is the same order, but you make it continue, right? And it is more than a mineralogical cylinder.
It's different from random sample, no?
They have
spacing between modes.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
I want to remind everybody, speak up, because I'm not getting people in the back of the room.
I'm still confused as to what the statement is. So in Fox et al., there's a definite, specific mechanism for what generates the mass scale. But the unparticle propagator listed here is not actually calculated. Yes,
that's right.
So we don't actually know what it is, correct? Right?
You can write down an ADS description of unparticles and put in a background field that couples to your unparticle and gives it mass in the bulk with a certain scaling and gets this propagated.
If you do the Stefanov
deconstruction, take RS2, put in a background field that has a certain dimension, and give it a bet so it gives a mass to your.
You're saying that least all these things are the mass.
Well, it has some profile and there's some one suppressed back reaction that's not included, but it's blowing up in the infrared, so it's an infrared scale of the Planck scale.
But we have examples of that are actually solved Planck.
Yeah.
Well, definitely it's something I talked about again and again. Let me emphasize that I think this works here said somewhere on the internet. I'm not the best person in the room to talk about that, so I'm wait.
The second author is Mr.
Okay. Okay, so there were some unresonances from Tom. Let me just close with something which I think is kind of qualitatively different from many other physics particle physics models. One thing that is very different is that you have this strongly interacting conformal sector. And what that means in some sense is that multiple unparticle vorticities don't cost much. So in other words, you could imagine having a 6-0 coupling here. Normally in the standard model you would think that's crazy because everyone's suppressed by another coupling constant. But in this case, it's not so clear, at least to me. So, roughly speaking, I think it's true that you pay almost no price for adding on extra O's coming out of here. Now, of course, since the O's are invisible, what's the difference between having two of them and six of them? You know, it's just they're all not there. But you can, of course, convert these back into visible things by putting one of these interactions in. And so this O could go to two photons, and this O could go to E plus E minus, and this O could go to ZZ, something like that. So what am I saying here? What I'm saying here is that you will have suppressed rates for these multi-particle final states, but not because of this vertex, because it costs something to convert things back into the visible sector. But this leads to an interesting question.
Just saying, I still don't understand why this vertex wouldn't cost anything.
Well, you have a strongly enacting theory, right? So, adding on some extra O's.
This is the way of just saying, part on structure, I mean, this is just engaged, invariant way of saying a lot of the same things.
Okay, so, but at the same time, if you actually want to see more particles coming out of here, then you have to keep adding on actual interaction vertices that are suppressed by some presumably high scale. So there is still the sense that, you know, six particle final states are less likely than four particle final states. But nevertheless, this looks like something interesting to
pursue. Could I ask you another question? I mean, suppose you thought again of radiating one of these O's, but then you're going to say, okay, well, you might be just as probable to radiate seven of these O's rather than one of the O's. Does that change the phase space?
And then you have to put in the seven O's correlator there, too.
Right, so, in other words, we really don't know what the phase space looks like if what you just said is true.
Speak up.
You actually have a mass gap, right? All you require is that you produce one of the heavier particles, which then cascades down to lighter ones, and because there are so many of them. It's probably very likely that if you produce any unparticle, you actually produce many of them.
Yeah.
So then you don't lose phase space because they're all on shell decayed all the way down.
I see. In the case when the conformal symmetry is broken,
yeah.
There's an end scan.
If it's not broken, this statement I don't think would be terribly mysterious if these O's were all photons. I mean, the radiation rate is just dominated by successive single photon radiation, right? However, if you demanded there to be 18 E plus E minus pairs in the final state, the probability would be very small. It would be some diagram like this.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's any contradiction with you not knowing the phase space. You assumed it was just one unparticle production. I think that's fine. And again, just It's just the fact that that's just because, like as John would say, radiation doesn't come back, right?
But
you don't have to the presence of these vertices doesn't make you modify your calculation of the emission rate into these particles.
But doesn't it mean that if there is some piece you haven't encountered for that?
No, I mean just if you put in a four photon coupling, right, it would not change the rate for emission into photons.
Well, that I don't understand.
That's because there's a small coupling.
Yeah, I mean, if this is just as probable as one particle emission, you know, then I think all bets are off, aren't they?
Well, I mean, I think it's just because of unshellness. I mean, even if you had interaction like that, right, then the if you're doing the total radiation rate, I'm confused.
I'm
changing my statement. I'm confused.
I just want to answer one comment to Chuckles. I mean, of course, if the unparticles actually have mass, then you do pay something every time you have to make an extra mass.
Yeah, that's another story.
What I mean is that let's say you produce one helium particle, which decays to two lighter ones, and you have a whole cloud, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That's basically because you produce one of the heaviest ones, and the mass gap is much smaller than your initial energy.
Uh-huh.
I'm claiming that in that scenario, you would naturally tend to produce some of these.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but then, Chaka, you're assuming the different mass gaps, but in the
It's like accessing different parts of the KK power. If you produce a heavy KK guy, it splits into two lighter KKs.
Okay, so, like all the math.
There are a very small number of relatively precise things you can say about this.
Okay.
So here's the only one I can think of. Let's say you have two q-bars going exclusively to a photon pair and a lepton pair through an unparticle cell. Then the way you would compute that is that there's a three-point function of unparticle.
Yeah.
And that is totally determined by conformally parameters.
Okay, so.
And so there's an order one coefficient. And that's an example of the
so this is exactly what I'm going to talk about. So let me, because this is the one thing I thought of too. So we're on track.
But
yeah.
if it's inclusive, that is, that there can also be missing energy to unparticle. Then you get the four-point functions, which are not determined by
okay, Chad, you want to say something before we go to this next slide here?
Again, I think it's very different if you're talking about something we have a mass gap to discuss. Let's take the case which we think is probably the most case, which is the formal sector of the air as well, it's gauge compression. Producing something from gauge compression goes along. What does it do? It creates a spread of prolonged parts. Most of that stuff cannot be written in terms of gauge invariant global operators. It's spread out. There is no Volt law. So there is a certain probability that you may, in the end, engage in grant. But that's suppressed by 100 MC squared. Most likely, you get the car function. And you don't get any O's. You just get some big spread out Volt set of O's. On the other hand, if on top of that you have confinement at the bottom, then what will happen is things will rearrange themselves to engage in grant. Mesons, baryons, apples in general. And those are objects which are created by the gauge invariant. So if you have confinement, you will in the end get many of these objects which are produced by the doctor. But this is just a way of saying what happens in ordinary QC when you take the Z-loads on the gauge invariant. If you try to write it through the gauge invariant blocker, not the first one, but the other ones that come out are being produced through the spike. Really good to use this intuition together because both the gauge invariant and gauge invariant comes from the system.
Okay, thanks. So let's go on. This is what Michael already referred to, which is that one thing. No, that was great. One thing you can do, however, is take the first possible generalization to just making an O, which is to make two O's, so you have a triple O vertex. And so this is something Arvind Rajaraman and Hu Tzu too and I have been thinking about. And the nice thing about that is that that three-point function, 000, is actually determined up to a constant by conformal invariance. So it should look like that. And it's kind of an interesting little exercise, and I'm sure in the end of the day we'll see how obvious it should have been, but you know, basically this is something that comes very naturally in position space, but when you work in Feynman diagrams, you need to convert it to momentum space, so you start Fourier transforming it, and this thing ends up looking a lot like something which is a loop diagram with three different propagators in it, and you use all the Feynman diagram technology of Feynman parameters and stuff like this, and you can actually boil this down to something which you can actually put into Vegas or something and find cross sections. So, an example. Oh, I mean, so the picture was just simply to eliminate these three O's. O goes to two O's, and each O decays to two O's. Yeah. Right.
Then now I don't understand why the multiple vertices is at low cost. But I would think that you would just make two fermions to begin with in the first O, rather than go to two.
Well, maybe it was just the way I said it. It was confusing. What I was saying is low cost is just sort of getting this vertex. But once you have to convert them back to visible particles, I agree with you that there's a cost there. So that's all you're saying, right?
Right. So wouldn't we be dominated by, you use the four photon case, wouldn't we be dominated by just the
diphoton?
Yeah, diphoton production through the O is much larger.
Well, okay, let me keep going and unveil all of my ignorance about this, and then you can say the same thing again, okay? So, you can calculate this. So again, this is blue to O to two O's, then the four gammas. And you can calculate distribution. So, for example, here's the TT distribution for the leading and the second and the third photon. And I think, you know, you can do this right. Maybe we even did it right. But the big mysterious thing for me, at least, is what is the natural value of the rate for this thing? Because the typical thing is you say, well, you know, you shouldn't put in big couplings, so order one couplings are what are required at most to have a reasonable guess as to what this is. I don't see that there's any handle, at least I can think of, what the natural constant is in this 3-0 correlator here. Certainly, it's corresponding to some sense to the coupling constant of the conformal theory. But, you know, what's wrong with having a coupling constant that's a 10 or 100? It's not blowing up the Landau pole, it's just conformal, right? So, as far as I understand, and I'd be very grateful if someone would explain it to me, I had no idea what the actual rate is for this. And the only thing I know is that it can't be too large or we would have seen it already. So it's constrained by experiment. But the minute you do an experiment, you turn on the LHC and run for a few days, you could be probing new parameter space where these four photon signals could be from one particle. And I think this is a really qualitatively different sort of story than normal perturbative physics.
So you want to look at multiple states with electrically particles, so the ratio of states is more out of the EM, but more complex.
Exactly. So what I'm saying is that, yeah, so, you know, we did the four photon one because we wanted to turn on only vector boson couplings, so we turned on the gluons and the photons. But of course, you could have turned on anything you wanted. So, you know, photon-photon VV, photon-photon EE, digamma, diamuon, you know, anything you want.
Generally, it would take collection of IPG events.
Just
look at the
multiple distribution
of initially
electrically
particles.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So it's
much more
flat than it's given. This gets back to one of my earlier questions, which is why you're saying that O is no longer invisible. And you know, John would insist that O is some kind of continuous that has no thing, that has no probability for going back to gamma-gamma. So, which is true here.
So I think you can... You can calculate things where the O's are all internal and virtual. Right? I think that's on solid footing. But when you ask for, say, let's say I want to know what the lifetime of the O is,
yeah,
calculate
the
decay rate. But then you have to have an O in the initial state. And there's nothing I said in this talk which tells us how to do that.
Okay, so how do you know that these O's are going to actually materialize into two photons at any significant probability within the detector?
Because I know the O two photon coupling, and I know the O propagator.
Okay, well, I just to precise my earlier question, John was saying
this is probably the
it's a question of
you have a mass gap here.
Well, you know, in some sense, you don't care for this calculation if there's a mass gap or not.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were saying. Yeah, for mass gap, that's slightly. But
I just want to say, it's hard for me to believe. I don't know nothing about conformal field theory, but it's very hard for me to believe that there isn't some sort of unitarity bound on that three-point function. You know that if we were doing tree-level physics, right? There's a unitarity bound just on any tree-level diagram if I take some dimensionless coupling and pump it up too much. And there it's a little less clear because, well, then the loops become important, and so you can't, you know, all you really know is the theory's breaking down. But you're writing down the exact three-point functions. And I know that the particle interpretation is not a particle interpretation, but I have a really, there's a value of a dimensionless coupling like 4 pi or something, right, where unitarity breaks down. I'd be really surprised if there weren't something like that here. Because it's still correlation functions, and the fact that you have weak coupling on the outside is not an excuse for unitarity, because when you cut, you know, if you had to build a regular particle, you would take that factor out before you check unitarity. Just the probability that you have, the fact that you have a small probability to produce something, it still has to interact with probabilities that add up less than one after you've produced it, right? So, anyway.
I'm very surprised about this too, but I can't find anyone who can tell me how to actually quantitatively get it, you know, resolve it.
Once again, it's just to calculate two to two process for all at three levels. And then compute the same thing for the box.
Well, I'm right off the bat not going to know how to do that. I don't know how to pose the initial
state. So if you don't know
how
to calculate
I'm aiming at the correlator.
Okay.
So just calculate the correlator, the 4-point correlator, the 3-level. So just using only the 3-point coordinates.
Somehow you think going to the 4-point coordinates is going to
be. That's the easiest, that's the obvious one I can think of.
But that's the one where there's some, you know, this one at least was constrained by conformal.
The contribution of the 4 points from just 3 points.
Oh, so just have
two three-point
vertices.
Three level, you know,
yeah, but what if you just have a 4-point that comes from nowhere, cancels it or something?
No, but the point is a strong coupling. The 3-level contribution from the 3-point to the 4-point should be comparable to the loop contribution from the 3-point to the 4-point. And you can see that box diagram only involves 2-point functions and 3-point functions.
Yeah, but Tafa, what do you need a box diagram? Just a triangle diagram, you can get the loop contribution to the 2-3 point itself.
That may even be simpler. Yeah. So when the loop contribution to the 3 point is comparable to the 3 point, then you're a strong
coupling. But is that bad?
Well, that just tells you what the natural sign of
that is. Then you'll get an idea of what's coupling.
You couldn't, but you still could turn it up. We still haven't established some kind of unitarity limit or something like that.
No, it's not a unitarity limit. It's kind of modest.
Yeah, but that's
a practical
limit. It's like a perturbative limit.
Yeah, perturbative limit. Exactly.
Yeah.
You don't want the loop point.
But I don't see that that's a limit on the strength of the coupling. It's maybe where a strong coupling sets in, but we still haven't established any kind of limit from that consideration.
Johnson, do you have a mass gap
here?
Or no?
He says he doesn't
care. As long as
which I don't understand, but anyway.
As long as the energies involved, the ICs are much bigger than the mass gap.
So if there's a mass gap, and then you get those unlikeness, if you look at the photon-photon interference, or I got it wrong?
Well, yeah, there will be a contribution from when this goes on shell, but.
So, from the physical standard model,
the final state point thing only is not a model. You just set up the calibrate or parameterize multi-point correlation functions. That is multi-point correlation function at calibrate or parameterize. And I would conclude is that if this state does not have mass gap, and some of the energy goes to these sectors, there's no particle. This is a mass gap, you just attach to that bound state in this hidden sector. And then, of course, atomization particles show up, you cannot compute, but at least conceptually, you can use it. Because you just go to things.
Yeah.
But if you have that, does not have a mass gap, then. And it's not the final state is not only a more, but some stuff which is still seen. Other place conceptually very clear.
But your question has not to do so much with this 3-point, just a general question, right?
Yeah, 3-point is special shape. 3-point, and if it goes to standard model 3, you just attach the standard model final state, and then control the 3-point for the data, just attach the standard model.
Yeah.
And if there's a mass gap, even in one of the final states in this sector, in the receptor, you conceptually feel that you just attach that state. Of course, this correlator, this operator has to be converted into state, and that has some value. But that is a conceptual conceptually. But without mass gap, yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay, I'm not sure I'm getting the point of your point. Okay, let's talk some more. I think we're out of time, even including the 30-minute discussion. Scott, you have one last thing?
Well, there's one theory when we go for.
Okay. So you say from that we can conclude something about all the other possibilities? About all the other possibilities.
No, I think just in that theory we know what the answer is.
Generically enlarge in all of these are point couples.
Because having interaction with the yeah, it's just MC. Yeah.
But the question was,
okay, so let's finish up. I mean, this is the conclusion on this one, at least, you know, pending all this theoretical discussion. Even if this is order one, I have a feeling that these sort of states show up with a much higher cross-sections than in other perturbative theories. And so we're talking about extremely high PT things, these kind of things should stick out, and they might be something very interesting to look at early in the LHC version. So, quick summary, fun particle again, I hope that we'll talk about this, people who will be leading it, John and Greg certainly have a lot of things to add. What I want to emphasize is that the conformal window is probably not completely open down to zero energy, and so it implies that if you want to have a robust probe of TEV conformality, you better look at high energy colliders. You can't rule this out with supernovae or G-2 or muon or anything. So virtual in-particle production gives you all sorts of contributions to rare processes. Real in-particle production, and then the scenario I've been talking about gives you missing energy, but again, there are possibilities maybe of colored in-particles, something like that. This last bit is the most speculative by far, which is that multi-ion particle production could imply spectacular signals with, you know, 4-6 lepton photon sort of things. And last, there is always a possibility that you can do something which would kind of sound like a precision measurement, which would be sensitive to this very bizarre kinematic property of the physics. So we talked about top goes to U n particle, which is continuum even in a sort of so-called two-body decay. I think that hasn't been explored enough, and there may be possibilities of figuring out new physics, sense of the Hope particles from this sort of idea. So that's hopefully a little bit of foundation of what's going on here. Thank you so much.
So what is the plan now, Marcus?
I don't know. Our captain is going to lead the discussion.
Are we going to get a break?
John, do we have a coffee coming on?
The coffee is supposed to come at 3:45.
Maybe we should take a rest. Let's take a rest for maybe 10 minutes, and then when the coffee comes, we'll briefly interrupt the discussion. Is that okay?
John, four photons, not six photons, or two photons.
Well, depends on the time you add on.